This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, this is Ken Tangen. This is episode 39 of What's It Like. My guest is Kevin Purdy, who is a writer and lives in Buffalo?
Buffalo, New York.
Buffalo, New York. Well, of course, this is summerishness, but Buffalo in the winter?
Yeah, well, Buffalo in the winter, you know, you buy a shovel.
I see.
You own rock salt. I mean, it's not, humans have adapted over the years. It's, you know, not the first settler to get here.
That's
but,
true.
It is, today it's like 73 and sunny. I have my porch open, so, you know, not so bad.
So do you spend more time at the Albright Knox Gallery or at the Lucy Desi Museum?
Oh, well, the Lucy Desi Museum is in Jamestown, which is, you know, a little bit of ways. The Albright Knox is amazing. They just installed a really cool structure outside of it. I spend most of my time at the really amazing restaurants around town. And
known for the Buffalo Wings?
And many other things. And the Belgian beer bar right around the corner. And, you know, really good Italian and Polish food you can get here. So.
Did you grow up in Buffalo?
No, I grew up in Syracuse, which is 2 hours down the thruway. Well, a suburb north of Syracuse. And when I came to Buffalo, it was the biggest city I'd seen at that point. Laugh, you know, insert monologue here. But
it's a pretty big city.
It is. It, you know, when I was in college, I think it was 300,000 in the city. And right now there's about 1 million plus in the general area. So
yeah,
I really like it here, though. It's a big city. And of course, It's a cliche to say, but it's a big city with a small town feel. You know, you meet people, you can usually connect one or two levels in to someone they know, you know, someone they worked for, stuff like that.
So what brought you to Buffalo?
College. Then what kept me here was working in newspapers. Right out of college, I worked for the Buffalo News. I went away for a year and worked at a newspaper in Ohio, the Sandusky Register. And then I came back to Buffalo because my girlfriend of a few years was here, and now she's my wife. And I just like it here. Mm-hmm. I really do. As you can see, also, if you're looking on video, I have the skin tone and temperament of a guy who lives in a northeastern city, not a SoCal type of dude.
Well, I'm an albino and live in Southern California, so we may not necessarily pick on the basis of the best climate for ourselves.
That's true.
So, growing up, did you always want to be a writer?
No. I read every day. I did read a newspaper, the Syracuse Post-Standard, almost every morning growing up. And I was on the high school newspaper, but I just thought that was because I could string a sentence together. I didn't really think it was a vocation of mine. I went into college for film. You know, I wanted to be a director because nobody else wanted to. I grew up on DVDs. I wanted to do music production for a while. Fredonia near here is where the Flaming Lips and Mogwai and other cool bands got their start with David Friedman. I thought I was going to be David Friedman. And, you know, I wanted to do a lot of different things. My dad always wanted me to be a lawyer. Midway through college, I started thinking about becoming a chef or, you know, that type of thing. But all throughout, I guess, constantly, I was kind of writing, often writing about the things I was geeking out about, like music and film. And then it turned out, like, eventually I just said, well, maybe I could just try writing and getting paid for that as opposed to trying to break into these fields with writing. So that's what I did.
How did your parents impact your worldview?
My dad was a fish distributor. He bought fish off the boats in Iceland and Canada and chopped them up and sold them to schools and restaurants. He grew up on a farm. He grew up in Brooklyn, and then his formative years he spent on a farm in upstate New York. He was a pretty no-nonsense guy. I don't want to say that he reined in my flights of fancy about film or music or anything, but he gave me a kind of belief that if, you know, you need to be working at something, that you can't get by BSing people. You know, you need, like, if you want to get paid for the hour, you need to produce something for that hour, whether that's copy or, you know, interesting talk sometimes or whatever, like, you know, you just need to. And so I could never really see myself living on loans and working, you know, and working toward an art or, you know, going to graduate school. I also didn't like college, so I didn't really enjoy a lot of my classes or the structures, and it's just not my discipline. So I think my parents gave me a sense of, if basically, actually, when I wanted to go to film school, my dad said, well, get your degree and then I'll send you to film school. Basically, get a degree in anything at all, and I will send you to NYU film school after that. But, you know, show me you can do something besides talk about Scorsese first. So,
and did you do that?
Well, yeah. And then, of course, my path diverged from doing that.
Did you enjoy school when you were growing up?
Yes and no. I was okay at it. You know, I could write a paper when I needed to, but I...
What was your major challenge?
It was time management, and it continues to be to this day. Of course, now I like bill people and try to organize multiple clients into a week. But, you know, it's still... So time management. And so I would always be doing my paper, you know, the morning before something was due, or spending all afternoon lazily reading through history when I should also be doing math. And, you know, but then, of course, it's like you kind of enjoy the thrill of winging together a paper at the last minute and then having it get a B minus. And you're like, all right, B minus. Like, sadly for me, that was a bit of a thrill. So unfortunately, you know, I had positive and negative reinforcement on my worst habits. So
was the thrill that you didn't work a lot in order to achieve?
Well, this is going to sound terrible because I'm a professional writer, but the thrill was that I was able to convey an understanding and nuance of topics that maybe I didn't really have done all my reading for, you know, which I don't want to say that's what I do for a living now, but I am able to scan large amounts of information and put together a compelling narrative on it, hopefully. Mm-hmm. And so I if I had to tie, you know, my childhood and my schooling to my current life, I would say that's kind of a common thread that, you know, I can't actually learn everything there is to know about a topic and then write about it, because I'd only bill one article a year, you know. But so yeah, that's kind of what that's kind of the guilty pleasure of school was. It backfired on me occasionally. You know, I turned in a paper about the prohibition that was implied it was a giant racist conspiracy. That didn't go over so well. But, you know, it was because I'd done this quick scanning on the internet, which was this new thing at the time. And I came up with this, you know, a theory that obviously was because we all hate Irish immigrants. And that's why prohibition, which, yeah, anyways. So that's where I think some of that thrill came from, and those bad habits.
Now that you've survived childhood, what constitutes family for you?
Well, right now I'm married and I have no kids, but I have two cats. But I keep in touch with my extended family, and that's my family right now. My actual atomic family is a very small unit here in Buffalo, but my extended family, I have my mom in Syracuse, my sister in Arizona, relatives all across upstate New York, New Jersey. And I actually, you know, when you live with your wife somewhere away from your family, both sides of your family, hers and mine, I have a network of friends and friends, like even families, that have kind of created this kind of support network here in Buffalo, you know, so people need to watch the cats, or, you know, I, you know, literally need some to borrow a chair for a party or something. We have that, you know, so that's, I have a kind of makeshift family, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So what do you exactly do?
Well, it was confusing before. I don't think my mom and dad really ever quite got Lifehacker, which was what I was doing mainly for the last 3.5 years.
Which is a blog about how to get on in life?
Somewhat. So originally I was a newspaper reporter, ink-stained wretch, as they say. I left that to work for Lifehacker, which is a productivity blog. I guess you'd say a technology and productivity blog that was not so much, oh my God, look at the new iPhone, but here's how to load your work email into your phone and not have it, you know, double message you. Here's how to transfer your contacts from your old BlackBerry to your iPhone. It was a how-to blog, I guess you'd say. Mm. Now, how-to articles are all over the internet from various different, you know, sources, but Lifehacker is one of the first to really focus on the making technology better, not just celebrating every new piece of technology that comes out. And so I was a morning editor there. I'm on the East Coast, and most of my coworkers were on the West Coast. So I woke up every morning, read tons and tons of news, and filtered it into about 6 posts per day, but in very rapid succession, 30 minutes an hour, 30 minutes an hour. Then I was doing that for 3.5 years at Lifehacker. I'd done that for a while. I want to try something new, and I want to try working for myself, which, if I have to say, my dad certainly instilled me with a sense of anti-authoritarianism. I don't love working for other people for long stretches of time. My boss at Lifehacker was great, but I actually enjoy working for myself. So that way, when things go wrong, I can beat myself up about it. And when things go right, it's me. It's not, you know, some memo that went out. So now I literally just am a mercenary. I take assignments to write, you know, one post a week for this site, and I pitch ideas to editors at various newspapers and publications and websites and write them up. I follow the news still to get an idea what's going on there, but I write food reviews for a local magazine. I just write. And that's my main production. And then my secondary line of work is finding people to sell those words to, which, you know, is kind of a different path. And there have always been freelance writers, but it used to be a kind of very rarefied world where it was, you know, a guy who lives in Brooklyn and is renowned for his poetry, and he would sell to the New Yorker and, you know, the Atlantic and Saturday Evening Post. And now there's a lot of us who are writing on the web and moving much faster, turning around product much quicker, and, you know, kind of trying to use as much savvy as we can to sell that stuff.
Do you find a client first or write the article first?
I usually find the client first. Usually it's an email negotiation. I've been lucky enough that Lifehacker gave me a lot of exposure so that some folks have reached out to me. Freelance writing, you do try to not write the same article twice, never, because you usually sign agreements. As soon as you get your W-2 form and, you know, fill out your taxes, you get a form saying you can't, this is their property once you write it for them. But, you know, let's say you write about the history of railroads in Erie County, New York. You know, you can write a version of that article for one publisher who's doing a 500-word travel piece about visiting Erie County's railroads. By the way, visit Erie County's railroads. And then and then you can find a different angle on that. You know, you can write about the history of this one railroad that actually had slaves on it. It was kind of part of the Underground Railroad. Or you can, you know, do that type of thing. So you try to reuse knowledge that you've acquired so you don't have to reinvent the wheel every time. But I get to write about a lot of different stuff, which is part of the appeal for me working for myself.
What's the best thing about your job?
Two things, I guess. They're kind of one and the same. One is that, like I said, I get to write about different things. I don't feel tied to watch the news and jump on it, which, you know, I did enjoy it when I was a police reporter and a business reporter. I enjoyed running out and grabbing stories. There's something about a singleness of purpose that's very fun that I don't have these days. But it's also nice to be able to watch a news item come out about like Google losing passwords, not have to jam on your computer and write something 400 words that you'll regret later about it that look appallingly alarmist in hindsight. But to then take that and then, you know, kind of figure out how you want to pitch that to folks and write about that in a certain way. And, you know, the next week do a story about improving your passwords for a different doing different things all the time, and then writing about food and writing about things like that. But the very basic thing I like about my job, though, is that I set my own hours. So if I have a spurt of creativity at 10 p.m., you know, I can use it to write. And then if I want to nap from 1 to 3, I can too, and, you know, if I need to run to the grocery store in the middle of the day to get eggplant for eggplant parmesan, got that too.
So you're more of a magazine writer than a newspaper writer now.
Yeah, if only because newspapers don't have a lot of budget or time for freelance writers these days. And, you know, by magazine, I guess I kind of mean online news magazine. But yeah, I guess more so, yeah.
What has surprised you about your job?
That it exists. that I should say that I'm also married to a woman who's very successful. And so that's part of the support net I have, is that I don't need to worry quite so much about the rent every month. You know, I know that there's rent and food, but just that it's possible to string together a career in Buffalo, New York, of all places, writing about technology from multiple clients and even some local folks, you know, who are willing to pay for that type of information, or consulting, which I do a little of too. Just the ability to put together a career without a basic 37 and a half hour work week for one, you know, employer.
Although you have written a book, which must have taken you more than a few hours.
But I wrote that while I was working at Lifehacker, actually. And that was nights, weekends, lunch breaks, long hours in the library. It's the complete Android guide. And I wrote a book because never wrote a book before. And also wanted to, I was obsessed with Android phones, the new smartphones. And my friends and relatives and one of my former editors had told me, like, you know, it's such a weird phone. It's like an Easter egg phone. And like, you know, you hit menu and then you hit the more, and then you hit settings, and then you pull down this menu in settings and you'll find like the thing you were looking for, but it's five layers deep. And so that was part of the reason writing the phone. I was like, I felt like people wished that someone would actually go in and do a lot of investigating mm-hmm. and put it in one handy guide.
It's available both in paperback and in ebook versions.
Yes. Yep. We cover every major e-reader, so you can read on your iPad, which oddly enough, and then you own an Android phone, your Kindle, etc. CompleteAndroidGuide.com.
Which sells more?
Oh, the ebook by far. Partly because the folks who own an Android and want to learn more about it, you know, want to have it right there, and it's also easier to buy. Because we're a small firm, we kind of do on-demand printing, so the print copy is not the cheapest thing. It's like $15 to $20, depending on the sale. So, you know, we sell a lot of the ebook version.
Is there another book in the works?
I have thought about it, worked around it. I'm actually working with my publisher right now to think up some ideas of some things we might do. But it'll probably be independent as well. Kind of, you know, self-promoted, self-published, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. When you work in the tech field, book contracts are sprints. Because by the time you spend 6 weeks writing it, then they're going to spend 3 weeks marketing it and coming up with a cover and coming up with distribution plans. And then there's a few weeks of editing and proofing and getting the, what is it, the from the Library of Congress thing you have to actually go and get. And so if you wrote a topic like Android 1.5, it's the greatest. By the time you get that book out, Android 2.0 will be out and your book just sits dead on the shelf. So book contracts for major publishers in the tech field are mad dashes. And a lot of my friends do them, and more power to them. But I like the independent model because I can also then update my book on mm-hmm. the fly, you know, and just push it out there as soon as it's ready.
Well, more with Kevin Purdy right after I remind you of the good work being done by St. Jude's. My kids are grown up, but I have pictures of them when they are little. I love the big smiles and goofy eyes, and they're just being kids. If you like pictures of kids, I got a suggestion for you. Go to sdjude.org. and look at the bottom right-hand side of the page. This is the site for St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, and the picture is their patient of the month. Every month you'll see a great picture, and they'll remind you of kids that you know. But these are kids who need your help. So as long as you're on the site, click on the donate button. It costs over $1 million a day to operate St. Jude's. So please, chip in. So, Kevin, everyone has to give themselves self-motivation occasionally. Mm-hmm. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
Lately, the checking account has been a great... I mean, because I went from even at Lifehacker, where I was technically an independent contractor, you know, the direct deposit arrives once a month, and it's a whole mm-hmm. month's worth of work that arrives in your checking account. And it's like, ah, there it is. And then you just work the next month, and then it arrives again. When you're independent and you're a freelancer, I wrote a 2000 word piece for a magazine recently, and it's been months because they haven't published it yet. And they're not going to pay me until it gets published. And they know how many words I wrote, and so they know what to pay me because we agreed on a rate per word. So, you know, it felt great at the time. And I spent 2 weeks dashing out this really, what I thought was a really good article. But I haven't heard anything from them for a while. Same thing with, you know, to a lesser degree, other clients, news magazines. You know, everyone has their own accounts payable, accounts receivable departments. So I get motivated to, like, you know, right now, maybe after we're done here, it's like, maybe I should pitch somebody and see if I can make a quick $150 because, geez, you know. You know, so really just right now, finance. I have some long-term plans I want to get to, but day to day, it's just literally like, how much I got in the bank? How much more do I want for this month? And, you know, do I ever want to pretend that I have an IRA? Very, very caveman.
So what do you want to be when you grow up?
Boy, I want to keep doing this for as long as I can. I want to keep writing for myself. And I want to get better at writing. That's all I have on my plate right now is just get better at writing and impressing people with how you're able to take data and turn it into words.
When you have to calm yourself down, how do you soothe yourself?
I do. Actually, I meditate when I can. I'm a fan of Zen meditation. I'm not the greatest practitioner of it, but the most steadfast practitioner of it. But I try to take that kind of reasoning into mind every so often that, you know, this is the moment you're in right now. The next moment will be different. Looking at what your mind is doing at the moment and trying to figure out what am I actually, you know, frantic about? Like, why am I acting like going from Target to Rite Aid to the dry cleaners to home is ruining my life. Is it really, or is it that I'm actually thinking about how I don't want, you know, I don't want to see my relatives this weekend and how I do have all this stuff to do at home? You know, like what is really happening? And for someone who works for a bunch of different clients and puts too much on his plate, too many different things on his plate, that helps, you know, figuring out what moment you're in and what your mind is actually doing at that moment.
Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
Yeah, the passing of my father about a year and a half ago. That was a big moment because it was unexpected.
How old was he?
59-ish. Maybe 60. That's terrible. 59 or 60. Relatively young for modern times. And it put me in both an emotional position I'd never been in before. My family was very stable growing up. And it also kind of, when you're a man and you grow up with a father and you just kind of, you know, I'd always had a career, you know, ever since I graduated college, and you just expect like, well, my dad must think that I'm doing okay. And then without dad there anymore, like who needs to think that I'm doing okay? And who's going to be there to tell me that they've done it before, you know, and et cetera. And so you need to kind of figure out where you're going to get, if I say validation, it sounds like that's always a negative term, right? You know, like validation. I mean, like, where am I going to get my sense of self-worth from? Yeah. And you need to...
It's still a pat on the back.
Yeah, right. You know, people just use validation in a negative sense all the time that like, oh, we need to validate ourselves. But that's what it is, really. It's just what do I do now, basically? Which is a feeling a lot of people go through, but when they lose a parent. But like, what now? Like, I'm so used to this frame of mind. So that was probably the biggest challenge in my life that I can think of. And plus you think that you're going to bring your kids to it in your minivan to your dad's funeral. And you think that you're going to have to take the day off from work as a senior VP at Widgetech.
Mm-hmm.
For me, in my mind, you know, like that was like, as opposed to like, oh, I'm going to be, you know, on the couch and I'll be 28 or 29 and you know, et cetera. And I'll have to drive my, you know, figure out a babysitter for the cats and, you know, pick up me, et cetera. So yeah, it's always a shock, I'm sure.
What have you found helps you?
Sometimes thinking back on things he's said that I've tried to, you know, reason that I imagine live up to, but also finding, how do I phrase it? Finding things that are important and doing them well and devoting yourself to them as opposed to just, you know, only thinking like all about career and thinking about money and thinking about how nice your house looks, finding things of greater value and creating, like I said before, a support network for yourself that's even bigger than maybe your atomic family, which is now a little smaller.
If you were giving a commencement speech for high school or college, what would you say? What would be your best advice?
I guess I would say you have no idea where your career is going to go. And that I really don't know. Someone asked me the other day how many people are using their degree in exactly the way they thought going through college. And, you know, most of my friends, they would say no. You know, a few political science majors who turned out to be lawyers. I don't really know how that cuts. Like, that's kind of a general use of the political science degree. But I would just point out, I would probably try to come up with funny anecdotes about my friends who started in one place and in another. And that really the only values you have are your work ethic and your, you know, your general ethics, and those are the two most important things. Cause you know, you can't just live off of how great you are at sales. You can't live off of how great you are at writing or how talented you are at industrial design, because those things can change. People who worked at IBM 20 years ago, their careers have changed in those 20 years. You know, it's think about developing the soft skills, develop yourself. And then all the things you have to actually develop for someone else for money will come, and you'll figure out where to do it. Just in my own field of journalism that I was in, and still kind of in, there was a large amount of thinking that was going on at the time I was, you know, an active or newspaper reporter, is that graduate school for journalism is a very wonderful place to spend time and to do all that thinking about journalism. But a lot of newspapers and organizations would rather students come in with chemistry degrees so they can cover bioscience, or, you know, come in with an environmental engineering degree so you can cover the ever expanding, you know, green technology field, rather than come in with a journalism degree and be like, all right, I know what a nut graph is. Let's do this. You know, like et cetera. So that's the trend I've been seeing pretty much my whole formative life, I guess.
Last question is to help me get better at this process. Think of an event in your life or a story. Everybody's got stories that we didn't talk about. What question should I have asked to get you to tell me that story?
So what I really want to talk about is how hard it is to organize a conference, and if to go from not being a manager at all and to feel like I was never in charge of something and to all of a sudden be in charge of things like my billing and my invoicing and, you know, my clients on the one hand. And then also in my extracurricular life, I'm organizing a conference in Buffalo that's part of the TED Network. And that has been a whole Easter basket full of things I realized I'm not great at. So I guess to get there, you could have asked, is there something you're doing now that you never thought you'd be doing?
So Kevin, is there something you're doing now that you never thought you'd do?
Yes. Tell other people what to do, which was almost like a goal of mine my entire life, was to never be a editor at a newspaper and to never assign stories to other people and to never, you know, that type of thing. And now I'm doing it, and it's difficult. I guess what I'm learning from it is that it's okay to admit to other people that you don't, that it's not a forte of yours. There's ways to do it that are other better than others. To just send out an email with a subject help is a bad idea. But to actually like solicit the advice of three or four people in an organization and say, hey, yeah, you've done this before. You've run a smaller conference. Like, can we have coffee? I mean, that you can maintain leadership skills. You know, you can maintain a active role in something and still admit that you're new at it. And so I guess that's one thing where I'm doing something now I never thought I'd be doing. There you go.
I want to thank Kevin Purdy for joining me. Thanks, Kevin. I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you for having me.